I thank you all for coming very much. I'm glad that you are interested in the topic that I announced. And this talk will be part of my postdoc project that I'm carrying out here for 3 years, all in all. And I promise that each time I come here, because I'm much on travel and different archives, I promise that each time I'm here, I will present something and inform you, so to speak, how the project advances. I'm very glad that I have the opportunity again here. It's only the second time, so I don't know how it will be in the future, whether I can keep this promise each time, but so far I think it's fine. As I said, it's the second talk, and those of you who have been also present last time in December, you will remember that I was presenting a review of literature on editing Wittgenstein's Nachlass. And this is my whole project. It's about the history of editing Wittgenstein's Nachlass. So the first talk was about reviewing the literature, how this topic of editing Wittgenstein has been discussed. And you might remember that my conclusion was that we know already very much about what Wittgenstein has written, so what actually his Nachlass is, and we know a lot about how his papers have been edited and how the books were made. And therefore, I concluded at the very end of my paper last time that we are now on a stage that we can focus also on other aspects of this history of editing. And that would be to focus on the human story of the three literary executors of Wittgenstein. And this is interesting because it's a story that expands over 50 years, and these three characters who each of them became eminent philosophers in their own right, they devoted so much time and energy to edit Wittgenstein's papers. And the basic question of my project is then, what is it that motivated these three philosophers so much that they did this? So what was the significance of Wittgenstein's philosophy and their acquaintance with Wittgenstein, on the one hand, and on the other hand also, how is their understanding of Wittgenstein and Wittgenstein's philosophy mirrored by the editions they made? So there's also an underlying assumption that the editions that the editors made show what they understand and what Wittgenstein meant to them. This is, so to speak, the broader picture of what I'm working on for 3 years. Now, for today, I start with this, taking up this conclusion of last time, and begin to investigate the story of editing Wittgenstein, which naturally begins with the death of Wittgenstein. The history of Wittgenstein's Nachlass begins. But today, I look a little bit back into time when Wittgenstein was still alive. It's, so to speak, a prelude to this story of editing Wittgenstein, to look how the relationship between Wittgenstein and this tree, who became his heirs, was, and how this developed. Good. One more word in advance. I have to admit something, that although I tried very, very hard during the last days to finish this prelude, it was not possible to finish it. This whole story of the relationship between Wittgenstein and von Richt, Rasch Riest and Enscombe might fall into 7 parts, as I plan it now. And I managed to write three, perhaps three and a half parts of this. And nevertheless, I think it's more than enough to fill this timely schedule for one presentation. I think we might even, we would surely cover the first two parts of it, and then time might already be out. But it's enough, and although this might be a little bit disappointing for you that you are not presented with the whole piece, which would be a rounded story, but rather with the beginning of it, it might give you an idea of where I'm going. And that would be very, well, this would be my aim. I would be glad if I could transmit the idea of what I'm attempting. And as this is the very first presentation of this long story, would be very glad if there were critical discussion and question afterwards. So there's a lot to be shaped yet. Good, so I begin with this paper, then after this long, long introduction. Good. And I call this project an intellectual biography of Wittgenstein's Nachlass. So to make clear that I want to include the whole human story and the significance of the literary executors in the story. Good. As a prelude of an intellectual biography of Wittgenstein's Nachlass, I want to gather what is documented on the relationships between Wittgenstein and his later literary executors. It is important to study these personal relationships since they put us in touch with the soil from which the editions grew. We may understand better why Wittgenstein bequeathed Ries, von Richt and Enscombe with the task to publish his writings, and not, for example, Schaffer, Malcolm, Drury, or his sister. And we may understand better why the heirs acted later as they did in fulfilling their given duty. Part 1. When Wittgenstein signed his will in January 1951 and thereby appointed Ries, von Richt and Enscombe to publish from his writings what they thought fit, he set his name under a decision that matured over a long time. For more than 20 years, he has been working with great seriousness and intensity to prepare a second philosophical book. His signature was the final acknowledgement that he would never see the harvest of his labors published. But the idea that he would not finish his work was everything but new to him. Already, in the days of writing his early work, Tractatus, he had instructed Russell to publish his writings in case of his death, and little later he had sent his dispositions by will to his sister Hermina. That he would not be able to shape a second book, so such he would like to send it to the printers, he had sensed all along. The choice to bequeath Ries, von Richt and Enscombe can thus be regarded well considered. He had known the three for a while and he respected each of them. Ries was the one among the three who accompanied Wittgenstein the longest. He had first come to Wittgenstein's seminars in the academic year of 1934-35. Francis Skinner and Alice Ambrose were just taking down into the Brown Books a very early idea for a book concept. In the lectures of that time, Wittgenstein examined the notions of following a rule and continuing a sequence. Theodore Redpath, another attendant of those lectures, helps us to imagine how they took place. And I quote the memories of Theodore Redpath. There must have been about 2 dozen people in the room, some standing, some sitting on deck chairs. Everyone was waiting for 5 o'clock when the lecture was due to start. Wittgenstein himself was sitting on one of the deck chairs near the stone mantelshelf. When, on the dot of 5, he sprang to his feet and, resting an arm on the mantelshelf, turned to his audience and began to lecture, one was impressed by the alertness of his face and the intense gaze of his clear blue eyes. His demeanor struck me as imperious, and he seemed to me to look more like an active general than a mystical philosopher whose appearance I had concocted in the crannies of my brain. And Reinhardt goes on to say, Wittgenstein's style of lecturing was quite unlike anything I had come across. His own train of thought would frequently come to a halt. On such occasions, he would sometimes sit astride a small upright chair, resting his arms on the back or holding the top of the uprights, and curse himself roundly in such terms as, "Damn my bloody soul." Sometimes, on the other hand, he would shout out, "Help me, someone." And then some member of the audience might make a suggestion, if he thought there was something in it, he would encourage the speaker to continue by "Yes, go on," said tentatively, and with a typical gesture of pushing his hands flat against each other with outstretched fingers towards the speaker. Redpath remembers that Wittgenstein's expressive behavior impressed students so much that several members of his audience, including himself, began to pick up his mannerisms. C.D. Broad, who had recently been appointed professor of moral philosophy at Cambridge, was so annoyed by the dominance of Wittgenstein's speech that he asked him not to attend any longer the meetings of the Moral Science Club. When Wittgenstein was there, he himself avoided to attend. As he later explains, he was not prepared to spend hours every week in a thick atmosphere of cigarette smoke, while Wittgenstein punctually went through his hoops and the faithful, as punctually, wandered with a foolish face of praise. Rush Rees, however, was probably not one of those followers. For him, it was neither extravagance nor mystic fame that attracted him to Wittgenstein's lectures. Indeed, Ray Monk informs us that he had at first been put off attending Wittgenstein's lectures by the mannerisms of Wittgenstein's students. But in February of 1936, he overcame these misgivings and attended all the remaining lectures of that year. An almost allergic reluctance to the fashionable seems characteristic for the young Rush Rees. But young might be not a completely adequate description here, for Rees wasn't that young anymore when he first sat in Wittgenstein's classes. He had completed his 30th year, and his life up to this point describes all but a straightforward path. Born in Rochester, New York, he had begun studying in 1922 at Rochester University, where his father was a devoted university president. And the father, by the way, should serve in this position for more than 30 years. Today, the library is named after him, as well as the Rochester's impressive Rush Rees Tower. This prominence, however, couldn't protect Rees when he objected to the doctrines of his teacher in the ethics classes. He had to leave the philosophy class because of his strong-willed views. The New York Times reported on this incident with the front page headline, "Radicalism of Rochester President's son causes professor to bar youth from class." In the article, Rees is quoted, "I am a radical. Dr. Forbes is not. That is why I am debarred. From a Puritan, I have revolted into an atheist." And radical was Rees' reaction indeed. He not only left Dr. Forbes' class, but he left the United States for good. He continued studying philosophy in Edinburgh with Professor Norman Kemp Smith, who wrote about his new student. "He's quite a picture, like the young Shelley, and rather lives up to it. Though quite a nice and simple youth, wearing his shirt collar loose and open at the neck." Perhaps Smith wasn't too mistaken when he continued, "Why he has been sent over to Edinburgh, I can't quite make out. I cannot help thinking that he must have got into some kind of trouble." Rees was a rebel. However, he finished his studies with an excellent first class honors in mental philosophy. In autumn of 1928, he was given a lectureship in philosophy at the University of Manchester. Professor J.L. Stokes, whose assistant Rees had become, testified him a wholehearted commitment in teaching in a wide range of courses. Rhys's extraordinary devotion for conducting philosophical seminars repeatedly appears in statements about him. When Rhys's lectureship in Edinburgh had come to an end, he decided to move to Innsbruck in order to study with Alfred Castiel, an expert on Brentano. According to D.Z. Phillips, his interest soon centered on Brentano's theory of relations, and more particularly on how it related to issues concerning continuity. When Rhys left Austria, Professor Castiel wrote about him, "I must confess that I looked forward to the hour of our meeting each day, with eager curiosity, in expectation of the new material which he would bring, for the relation of teacher and pupil had become inverted. I was chiefly the receiver." So wrote Professor Castiel. In 1935, Rhys began doctoral studies at Cambridge. His supervisor was G.E. Moore. His research interest he had brought from Austria, Brentano and continuity. Given Moore's friendship and high esteem for Wittgenstein and the fact that Wittgenstein was lecturing on continuation while Rhys wanted to work on continuity, it is easy to imagine that Moore recommended Wittgenstein's classes. After Rhys had overcome his first reluctance, he soon became a regular attendant. Rhys's original forwardness and his acquaintance with Austria and Manchester, both places played a role in Wittgenstein's life, may have added to Wittgenstein's interest in Rhys. Thus, he became not only a student, but also a partner in conversation. He was among those who Wittgenstein talked to when considering what to do when his fellowship at Cambridge should come to an end. Rhys remembers, "At the end of the academic session in June 1936, I had tea with him and he talked about the question what he should do now. His fellowship was coming to an end and the question was whether he should try to get a job of some sort or go somewhere by himself and spend his time working on his book. As we know today, Wittgenstein decided to move to Scholden. Here he had been successfully working before World War I. Now he intended to translate the Brown books into German. What this attempt led to, we know today as well." Rhys describes the decisive moment in Scholden such: "He brought the translation with minor changes and insertions to the beginning of the discussion on voluntary action." And this was a work of several months in Scholden. "And then he wrote in heavy strokes, this whole attempt at a revision from the start up to this point is worthless. That was when he began what he now have as the first part of philosophical investigations." In the life of Rush Rhys, the year 1936 was decisive as well. He gave up his hopes to produce anything worth submitting as a dissertation. His supervisor, G. Moore, was very sorry to receive this decision. Like Professor Castiel before, Moore noted he had benefited much from discussions with Rhys. And like Professor J.L. Stocks before, Moore regarded him as exceptionally well qualified to lecture on philosophy. But such positive assessments could not change Rhys' belief, or rather disbelief, in his own powers. And here we encounter a further highly characteristic trait of Rhys that shall accompany him throughout his life, namely a heightened self-critical awareness concerning his own writing powers. Writing, especially in philosophy, has always been most important to Rhys, but, or perhaps because of this importance, written pieces had to stand up to highest possible standards, or shall I better say, to impossible high standards. Rhys' reluctance to publish anything in his later life, despite the fact that he was writing almost every day, testifies that his own production hardly ever met his idea of what a written piece in philosophy should be like. In his letters, he often expresses frankly this overcritical attitude towards his own achievements. And by the way, he expresses this very well. Rhys was a man of the spoken word in direct dialogue, and in his art of letter writing, he found an original way of expressing himself in writing appropriately. However, the open skepticism about his capacities and his strong unwillingness to compromise with demands of academic customs might have hindered Rees' career. But I can imagine that this attitude was all too well understood and respected by Wittgenstein. In his notebooks and diaries, we can find as well rigorously self-critical assessments. Indeed, Rees and Wittgenstein were probably at one with each other in the deep conviction that absolute sincereness to oneself and to one's capacities is a necessary condition for any serious work in philosophy, and further, that one's writing would show if this requirement is met. Thus, in critically reviewing written pieces in the search of an authentic expression, the spirits of the two men might have met exceptionally well. Perhaps this was one reason why Wittgenstein, on Moore's recommendation, asked Rees whether he would translate the manuscript he had brought from Scholten. Theodor Eckhardt, again, who had been asked in the same summer to translate the preface, notes what an exhausting task working with Wittgenstein could be. We sat, quote, "We sat for several hours one day thinking out not only every sentence, but pretty much well every word. And Wittgenstein got very worked up when he or we could not find words or phrases which entirely satisfied him. Time and again I found myself wishing to heaven that he would let me work on the German quite alone and present him with a version which he could then comment on and revise. But he pushed inexorably on, and though his interpositions were sometimes quite awry, as well as exasperating, one did learn something from the procedure. And it gave one an insight into Wittgenstein's fanatical care, both for accuracy and for style." Rush Rees was surely one of the persons best prepared to agree with such seriously scrutinizing each and every aspect of the translation. The following summer led into a period of intense cooperation with Wittgenstein. As Rees recalled, he had been trying to write on continuity in 1938, and in August Wittgenstein offered to talk about it with him. For about 3 weeks, they met every day. Once Francis Skinner was present, no one else was. I quote Rees here. "The discussions were in the afternoon and they were long. One finished after 7 hours." Throughout autumn and winter, Rees worked intensely on the translation and he regularly met Wittgenstein for discussions. When he had to travel to the United States in January, he left with Wittgenstein the fruits of his efforts. Wittgenstein was quite disappointed, and this in two respects. First, he thought that it was wrong that Rees had not submitted his writing on continuity as an application. He wrote to Rees, "I found your first chapter here and was disappointed that you had not sent it in. I think it was wrong not to do it, and I think you ought still to do if there's a chance that it might be overlooked that you're a bit late. I have only glanced at a few pages, and I can't do more at present, but I didn't at all have a bad impression. So why the hell you should wish to be your own examiner, I can't see." Wittgenstein's second disappointment concerned Rees' translation. Raymond puts Wittgenstein's reaction such: "Wittgenstein, who was never easily pleased with any attempt by others to represent his thoughts, was horrified at what he saw. The high esteem, however, in which Wittgenstein held Rees was not affected by his opinion of the translation. When he informed Moore that he had given the original typescripts of both the German text and the translation to Keynes, he added, 'By the way, please don't mention to anyone that I don't think highly of the translation. Rees did his very best, and the stuff is damn difficult to translate.'" And when Wittgenstein's impression of the translation became even worse, he pointed out to Keynes, "Yes, the translation is pretty awful, and yet the man who did it is an excellent man." The second part. Rhys' translation never appeared in print, and the exchange about it stops at this point, as there were other news Keynes had to inform Wittgenstein about. Wittgenstein had been, among others by Keynes himself, elected to succeed Moore as professor in philosophy from October 39 onwards. When this information reached Wittgenstein, it was early February. Lent term had just started, and Wittgenstein was lecturing twice a week in the rooms of his friend Smithies in King's College. Rhys was attending the seminars when one day two new faces appeared in class. Redpath, again, remembers this situation. Knowing his aversion to such invasions, I wondered what would happen. If I remember rightly, Wittgenstein asked them what they were doing and whether they intended to follow the course. They didn't really answer, at all events to his satisfaction. Indeed, he hardly gave them time to, for he added quite uncompromisingly, "I don't want any tourists here, you know." They were, however, allowed to stay for the rest of the lecture. One of these intruders was Georg Henning von Richt. Of course, von Richt himself remembers the incident as well. I quote him, "I went to his lecture in a room in King's College, introduced myself when he entered, and said that I had the chairman's permission to attend lectures in the faculty. Wittgenstein muttered something which I did not understand, and I seated myself among the audience. He started to lecture, and I became at once fascinated. The strongest impression any man ever made on me," I wrote in my diary that same day, and the statement remains true. At the end of the lecture, however, Wittgenstein expressed his great annoyance at the presence of visitors in his class. He seemed furious. Then he left the room without waiting for an apology or explanation. I was hurt and shocked. My first impulse was to give up efforts to approach this strange man. The young man of 22 years, who had self-confidently introduced himself to Wittgenstein, was not much used to rejection. Von Richt grew up in a wealthy and educated family which was part of Finland's Swedish-speaking cultural elite. Both his mother and his father had graduated from the Swedish Commercial College in Helsinki. While her mother completed her education in Germany, his father had studied economics and indeed philosophy at the University of Helsinki. Professionally, von Richt's father became a manager, but von Richt remembers him primarily as gentleman and intellectual who regularly met in a circle of academics, writers, and publishers. Concerning his own early intellectual development, von Richt reflects, "When I was 12, the doctors advised my parents to take me to the well-known health resort of Merano in Tyrol, formerly Austria. It was in Meran that my intellectual awakening took place. It happened through my acquaintance with the elements of geometry in the spring of 1929. This gave me a tremendous thrill and sleepless nights of thinking about triangles and circles, cones and spheres, and the mysterious number pi, whose value it was impossible to tell exactly." Around Christmas, the same year, von Richt had become 13, he had asked his father what philosophy was. His father gave him some helpful hints and a selection of books to read. Von Richt immediately decided that philosophy was his subject, and he never questioned this decision in later life. Accordingly, he matriculated to read in philosophy at the University of Helsinki immediately after high school. Professor of theoretical philosophy in Helsinki was at that time Aino Kaila. Kaila had spent a research period with the Vienna Circle and was now championing his form of logical positivism, which he called logical empiricism. Besides regular pensum, Kaila introduced von Richt to the new philosophy, primarily to the writings of Rudolf Carnap. Within one term, von Richt felt certain that logic had become his gateway to serious philosophizing. Thus, von Richt was only about 20 years young when he had shaped a firm idea that he would become a professional philosopher and that his branch was the logistic philosophy. This was, by the way, also the title of an article the young graduate published in the Swedish-speaking intellectual journal Nya Argus. This article displays both von Richt's strong conviction to the new philosophy, as well as his extraordinary gift to express his ideas in an accurate, clear, and accessible language, which is neither too technical nor oversimplified. Wittgenstein's Tractatus, which had been the literature for von Richt's final exam at Keiler, is also discussed in this article. Von Richt presents the Tractatus as a first-grade work of logistic philosophy, the consequences of which were explicated by the Vienna Circle. After graduation, von Richt suggested Keiler as a topic for a doctoral dissertation, the justification of induction. Keiler approved, and von Richt began to study the classics as well as modern authors on this subject. Among them were John Maynard Keynes, Richard Braithwaite, and C.D. Broad, all working at Cambridge at that time. Thus, when political events had intellectually tried out Vienna, von Richt chose Cambridge for his period of studying abroad. He arrived at Cambridge in early March 1938, having in mind to contact the authors he had studied in Finland. First, he visited Braithwaite, who surprised von Richt with the news that Wittgenstein was lecturing in Cambridge. Shortly after, he was received very friendly by Broad, chairman to the faculty. Broad gave von Richt permission to attend philosophy courses in Cambridge. With this permission in his pocket, he went to Wittgenstein's lectures. We have already heard what happened there, and that Wittgenstein disapproved of the idea that von Richt would begin to attend the course in the middle of the term. Contrary to his first impulse to give up efforts to further approach Wittgenstein, he dared to write him. To his surprise, Wittgenstein replied within a few days in a friendly, uncomplicated, and frank manner. I quote this letter of Wittgenstein. "Dear sir, I'm sorry I caused you the trouble of writing to me. I shall try to explain why the presence of two new people in my class the other day greatly disturbed me. I am in my classes doing my utmost to explain a very difficult matter to the students who have been attending my classes this term. I know that it is quite impossible for anyone coming in the middle or at the end of the term to get an idea of what we really are striving at. In fact, he must necessarily get wrong ideas. I hope you will understand this, and if you do, you will also understand why being aware of this fact disturbs me a lot when I should be concentrating entirely on my subject. If I could, as many other people can, prepare my lectures in writing and then read them off in front of the class, the presence of new people would not disturb me. But as I am unable to do this and have to think things out afresh while I'm talking, I am very easily disturbed. In answer to your letter, I suggest, therefore, that if you wish to come to my classes, you should begin at the beginning of next term, but please don't come to the last few lectures in this term. I hope you will see my point and not think me unfriendly in suggesting this. Yours sincerely, L. Wittgenstein. And P.S. If you like, come round to my rooms at 4:30 p.m. tomorrow to the above address. It may be easier for me to explain the matter to you when I see you than by writing. If you can't come, don't bother to reply. I shan't wait for you longer than 4:45 p.m. Von Richt was there on time. The conversation they enjoyed laid the foundation for a long friendship. As von Richt recalls, they mainly talked that afternoon about architecture and Norway. Also in later life, conversations between them often centered around non-philosophical topics. And this might be a suitable moment to highlight a second side of the young von Richt which we have neglected so far. For von Richt's interests were far from being one-dimensionally focused on logistic philosophy. Early in his life, he was acquainted with German, which gave him access to the literature which he called his spiritual home, Goethe, Schiller, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche. He His worldview was strongly influenced by Burckhardt and Spengler, whose Untergang des Abendlandes stood in the library of the parents' house. Describing his mood at the time, von Richt recalls, "No fact of history should fail to be stored in my memory and assigned its proper place in the complete picture of mankind's past, which I was going to build up for myself. No work of art should fail to be evaluated for its beauty and significance. These fancies were, of course, not part of a program for my professional work, but they were characteristic of the Stimmung in which I then viewed life." Although von Richt and Wittgenstein did not explicitly talk, for example, about Spengler in this first meeting, the ambitions and the mood of the young von Richt might have contributed to Wittgenstein's sympathy more than the logistic positions von Richt held at that time. In any case, von Richt was invited to attend Wittgenstein's lectures with the beginning of Easter term 1939. During the lectures, von Richt didn't take notes, but instead tried to concentrate on von Richt's train of thought. In retrospect, he said that he understood next to nothing. But the dialogues between Wittgenstein and Alan Turing, who also attended the lectures, he experienced as dramatic intellectual duels. Although von Richt might not have completely understood what was going on in the lectures, he was nevertheless completely shaken up by his exchange with Wittgenstein. The questions and methods of philosophy, which he had been considered settled when arriving on Cambridge, were suddenly put into question. That Wittgenstein's thinking didn't fail to immediately leave a stamp on von Richt's way of approaching his own subject is testified by the talk which von Richt gave at the Moral Science Club in May. The talk was entitled at the theme of his doctoral dissertation, The Justification of Induction. In this talk, one can almost grasp a departure from logistic views when von Richt first claims to show that the inductive problem is a pseudo-problem and then specifies in parentheses that this is a confusion of pictures which we associate with different terms. Whereas the notion of pseudo-problem belongs to a logistic duct, confusion of pictures sounds much more like Wittgenstein of the 30s. So does the very end of von Richt's talk, which is added to the typescript in von Richt's hand. I quote this. He ends his talk with the words, "The problem of finding a justification of induction is no problem at all in the proper sense of the word. That what matters is not that the justification of induction is lacking, but rather that there is nothing to justify. The inductive problem, like so many other problems in philosophy, is like a mist, and to solve the problem is to make the mist disappear. What I have said is not meant to be a proof for this. I have merely tried to point out a way which, if followed, ought to contribute to a clarification of the idea which of the ideas which we are apt to connect with this particular problem." To my knowledge, this is one of the rare cases in which von Richt could be said to have adopted a Wittgensteinian style. Later, he consciously yielded the temptation, and this might have been appreciated by Wittgenstein. The talk at the Moral Science Club shows von Richt receptiveness for new thoughts and his ability to instantly adapt his views to them. The talk was warmly applauded by all present, and it was surely yet another highlight of von Richt's time as a doctoral student at Cambridge. On the whole, it cannot be seen other than a remarkable success. Not only was the academic establishment at Cambridge very fond of von Richt after only a short while, C.D. Broad had invited him to dine at the high table of Trinity College, and there he made an extraordinary good impression on all the people he met. And on the other hand, he also earned the respect of Wittgenstein, whose position might be considered diametrically opposed to the academic establishment. This is an illustration of von Richt's extraordinary gift to mediate between extremes on the basis of his bright personality and gentle conduct. This trait is respected from parties even if they differ significantly from each other. In his position as one of the editors of Wittgenstein's papers, this capacity will prove very useful. Von Richt left Cambridge after only 5 months. Fearing outbreak of war, he had already thought of leaving in March. As war became more and more likely during summer and practical preparations took place in Cambridge, von Richt decided to travel home, regardless of the fact that Wittgenstein had offered to fund as a new professor an extension of his stay during next term. But writing from his summer residence at the Finnish coast, he made the significance of the last month clear to Wittgenstein. He wrote to Wittgenstein, "I must add very sincerely that already what I got from your lectures and my discussions with you during my time at Cambridge has given me a certain tune to follow into a realm of thoughts on the border of which I am standing, trying to listen carefully in order to take the right course to the place from where the tune is emanating. We do not know as yet whether I shall arrive there or whether I only shall take the wrong course over and over again. But the fact that I hear the tune is enough to fill me with lifelong happiness and thankfulness for that I have met you and been taught by you, even if for a very short time." And now begins the third part. I don't know if you'd like to continue for the third part or?
Yeah.
Third. It is almost no surprise, but yet another astonishing achievement that von Richt managed to finish his dissertation and further pursued his academic goals even under the difficult conditions of war. Rush Rees, by contrast, decided to leave the academia at all. In 1940, he became a welder in a factory in Swansea. Wittgenstein liked this decision, as it could be said of him in general to have had strong sympathy with forms of life in which manual labor plays a central role, as Rees puts it. Wittgenstein even advised Rees to stick to the welder job when Rees applied for a temporary post as lecturer at the University of Swansea. Rees didn't follow this advice and explained this decision later to Wittgenstein, almost apologizing for it. And he wrote to Wittgenstein, "I would like to say that I didn't just disregard your advice. I was worried by your suggestion at the time when I finally did decide to come here. I have seen a number of things which in favor..." Well, I think it's a very long quotation and we can skip this. He wrote to Wittgenstein and explaining his decision to take a job as lecturer in Swansea, despite the fact that Wittgenstein said, "Well, hold on to the welder job. This is honest work." So. Okay, and I think it is fair to say that Rees' decision was right and Wittgenstein's advice was wrong. Not only did all the assessment of Rees' capacities as a lecturer in philosophy, including Wittgenstein's own, he had written a recommendation for Rees earlier, not only have all these positive assessments have been proved correct, and Rees' capacity as a lecturer has been most appreciated and respected by his students and colleagues, Rees found also in Swansea a place he later regarded as home. Wittgenstein, too, discovered in Swansea a retreat from Cambridge. He visited Rees several times in Swansea during the war and got to like the people and the land. Rees has recorded some of the conversations they had during these visits about Freud and psychoanalysis. Not to forget, Wittgenstein's long stay in Swansea from March to September 1944, when he wrote 114 remarks on the philosophy of psychology, which became part of the philosophical investigations. Thus, it is only natural that Wittgenstein, contrary to his earlier advice, later passionately tried to convince Rees to take a permanent post in Swansea when it was now Rees who didn't want to continue in Swansea. And he is writing to Wittgenstein, to Rees. Wittgenstein is writing to Rees, now trying to convince that this is the right position for him. I was glad to hear that they had the sense to offer you an appointment again at Swansea. I wish to God you would take it. I don't know, of course, what your special reasons are for wanting to leave Swansea, but please weigh them down carefully. I should, for personal reasons, hate you to leave Swansea. Our talks and discussions have done me good. Don't stupidly throw away an opportunity of doing some good. Your derogatory remarks about your philosophical abilities and success are so much rubbish. You are all right. And I mean just that, nothing more and nothing less. Philosophical influences, much worse than yours and mine, are spreading rapidly, and it's important that you should stay at your job. That your success won't be brilliant is certain. In fact, it will be meager. It's bound to be. Please, if possible, if you possibly can, resign yourself and stay on. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to appear wise. I'm just as silly as you are. But that doesn't make you any less silly. So long, Ludwig Wittgenstein. P.S. Read this letter again from the beginning. Wittgenstein wrote this when he had already resumed lecturing in Cambridge after his long stay in Swansea. From that time onwards, there evolved a correspondence between him and Rees, who lectured at Swansea, on their teaching and their classes. One of these letters from November 1944 reads, I'm sorry, one of Wittgenstein's letters reads, I'm sorry to hear about the depressing circumstances under which you are working. Please don't give in or despair. I know how immensely depressing things can look. And of course, I'm the first man to think of running away, but I hope you will pull yourself together. Anyhow, there is nothing more difficult than to teach logic with any success when your students are half asleep. I have heard Braithwaite in my classes snoring. Please, Rees, go the bloody rough way. I wish you one moderately intelligent and awake pupil to sweeten your labor. Please look after your health. You can't expect good work when your health isn't really good, and colds are nasty things. I have so far been in good health, and consequently my classes haven't gone too bad, or should I say badly. Toulouse is coming to them, and a woman, Miss So-and-so, who calls herself Miss Anscombe, who certainly is intelligent, though not of Kreisel's caliber. Mrs. So-and-so was Mrs. Geach, Elizabeth Anscombe, who continued to call herself Miss Anscombe after having married Peter Geach in 1941. Miss Anscombe had been attending Wittgenstein's classes at latest since 1942, when she came from Oxford to Cambridge with a studentship from Newnham College. By 1944, she had become one of Wittgenstein's most enthusiastic students, as Raymond tells us. She reports herself of her experience in 1944 such. For years, I would spend times in cafes, for example, staring at objects and saying to myself, I see a packet, but what do I really see? How can I say that I see here anything more than a yellow expanse? I always hated phenomenalism and felt trapped by it. I couldn't see my way out of it, but I didn't believe it. It was no good pointing to difficulties about it, things which Russell found wrong with it, for example. The strength, the central nerve of it remained alive, enraged, achingly. It was only in Wittgenstein's classes in 1944 that I saw the nerve being extracted. The central thought, I have got this and I define yellow as say this, being effectively attacked. Unlike von Richt, Anscombe has published very little autobiographical reflection. What Anscombe learned from Wittgenstein and what he meant to her can thus probably best be seen in her philosophical work. However, it is highly characteristic of her that she refers in the few cases at the one just quoted, that she refers in these cases of remembering to philosophical problem and its treatment. The subject matter and the argument always played the central role for Anscombe, not the surroundings or circumstances of discussion. Roger Teichmann observed the same feature in her writing. She usually spends little or no time in providing a background or in justifying her main assumptions, preferring to begin in medias res. And such was her relation to the great philosophers of the past as well as to Wittgenstein. She dived into discussion with them, focused on the argument. Even if authors were for long centuries dead, she could treat their arguments as if they were just uttered in a lively conversation. This is already to be seen in her very first publication, a pamphlet called The Justice of the Present War Examined, written when she was still at Oxford. The paper presents a philosophical analysis of the British policies in 1939, explicitly from a Catholic standpoint. Anscombe had just converted to Catholicism, and she refers to Thomas Aquinas and Catholic traditions to make her point. She was neither then nor later afraid of using her philosophically sharpened arguments to defend Catholic assumptions and their consequences. Indeed, her commitment as a Catholic seemed to provide her with a hard crown of confidence from which her arguments gained strength. Wittgenstein was to Anscombe an original philosopher, on par with the great philosophers of the past. In conversation with him, she learned both respect for philosophical greatness as well as not being obedient when she thought they were wrong. But it would give a false impression if we assumed that her relationship to Wittgenstein was purely professional or impersonal. In fact, how could a relationship to Wittgenstein be purely professional or impersonal? Her husband, Peter Geach, remembers that friendship had developed during Anscombe's time at Cambridge. And I quote him when he's remembering the first part of 1946. Elizabeth's research studentship had expired, and not till the Michaelmas term of 1946 did she obtain a research fellowship at Somerville College, Oxford. We were very poor. Wittgenstein showed himself a true friend. He tried to persuade Newnham to do something for Elizabeth's career. Indeed, though he regularly did not wear a tie, he wore one for an interview with the principal of the college, quite in vain. Later on, he paid the fee for Elizabeth to go to a private maternity home for the birth of our second child, John Richard, in December 1946. He refused to regard this as anything but a gift, a characteristic expression of his generosity to which other friends have borne witness. Wittgenstein's support is also documented in a recommendation for Anscombe written around the same time. This recommendation shows his high esteem for her philosophical capacities. Whether the recommendation was helpful or not, Anscombe was finally given a research fellowship at Somerville College. When she was living in Oxford, she would still travel to Cambridge for tutorials with Wittgenstein. Indeed, she did attend all remaining lectures of Wittgenstein until his early retirement in 1947. She did not even let her pregnancy interfere with attendance at Moral Science Club meetings and at Wittgenstein's lectures, as Peter Geach later puts it. Mm-hmm. In a seminar that should become Wittgenstein's very last, she met a visitor from Finland, Professor von Richt. Von Richt had in the meanwhile become professor in philosophy at the University of Helsinki. During war, he and Broad stood in correspondence as long as censorship allowed exchange between two countries fighting on different sides. Broad supported von Richt's reputation in England significantly with three long articles in mind on von Richt's dissertation. In 1946, Broad had visited von Richt. Now, in 1947, Broad invited von Richt to give a lecture series in Cambridge. He was also invited for lecturing in Oxford and London. When von Richt informed Wittgenstein about his coming and his wish to attend his lectures again, Wittgenstein replied with a letter that shows his greatest esteem for von Richt, that shows that his greatest esteem for von Richt had not changed. He wrote to Gunrich, "Thank you for your letter of February the 14th. My lectures vary a great deal. They are sometimes satisfactory, sometimes very unsatisfactory. My mind, for reasons I don't know, often feels very exhausted. This equilibrium of mine is so labile that before long my lectures may become hopelessly inadequate and that after a struggle I might have to give up teaching. Why do I write all this? Because if you should feel sterile and exhausted, because if I should feel sterile and exhausted next Easter term, I would ask you not to come to my classes, for your presence in that case might make things more difficult for me. Otherwise, I shall be glad if you will attend. I'm glad that you are going to lecture here, and I know that by attending your lectures I could learn a very great deal. In spite of this, I will not come to them, for the sole reason that in order to live and to work, I have to allow no import from foreign goods, especially philosophical ones, into my mind. For the same reason, I haven't read your book, though I am convinced of its excellence. If you think that I'm getting old, you're right. So long and good luck. Of course, von Richt took the chance to attend the lectures. Due to them, he and Anscombe became friends already during Wittgenstein's lifetime. Von Richt had also many personal conversations with Wittgenstein. He remembers, "I saw a great deal of Wittgenstein and the impression he made on me was even deeper than 8 years earlier. Each conversation was like living through the Day of Judgment. It was terrible. Everything has constantly to be dug up anew, questioned and subjected to tests of truthfulness. This concerned not only philosophy, but the whole life." During one of these talks in Trinity's Fellows Garden, Wittgenstein let von Richt know that he planned to retire from his professorship, and he told him that he wished von Richt to become his successor. Von Richt was flattered, but at the same time frightened by the prospect. Naturally, Broad encouraged von Richt as well to apply. He was probably delighted by the idea. This might have been one of the very few cases in which Broad and Wittgenstein was at one with each other. While von Richt carefully deliberated if he should apply for the professorship, he was kept informed of what was going on in Cambridge by Anscombe. She too considered von Richt the right candidate for the position. It seemed that she mediated at that time sometimes in a tripartite communication with von Richt and Wittgenstein. Thus, Wittgenstein gets to know from her that von Richt finally decided to apply. As von Richt himself, Wittgenstein considers possible risks that might come with a professorship at Cambridge. And he wrote to him, "Miss Anscombe wrote to me a few weeks ago that you had put in for the professorship. I shall write the recommendation in a few days and send it to the register as you suggest. May your decision be the right one. I have no doubt that you will be a better professor than any of the other candidates for the chair. But Cambridge is a dangerous place. Will you become superficial, smooth? If you don't, you will have to suffer terribly. The passage in your letter which makes me feel particularly uneasy is the one about your feeling enthusiasm at the thought of teaching in Cambridge. It seems to me, if you go to Cambridge, you must go as a sober man. May my fears have no foundation, and may you not be tempted beyond your powers. Good luck, yours, Ludwig Wittgenstein." Von Richt was elected. In the middle of May 1948, he became the youngest professor in philosophy that Cambridge ever saw. And this is end of part three. So I stop here, and I can sketch how this goes further, because this prelude is not yet finished, but now is the time where Wittgenstein retired from his professorship to fully concentrate on his writing. And during this time, these friendships are deepened. So he sometimes returns to Cambridge and stays there with von Richt when he is a professor. and they enjoy many conversations, and as I said, especially about non-philosophical topics, about culture, the decline of civilization, and these topics. And the friendship with ENSCOM turns in a cooperation, really. And ENSCOM, not much later, is then chosen to translate the philosophical investigations. And this is already during Wittgenstein's lifetime, probably as early as the end of 1948, perhaps beginning of 1949, so good 2 years before Wittgenstein is dying, he managed and prepared what should happen with his writings and his publication after his death. And Ries becomes his Wittgenstein's executor, and ENSCOM is instructed how she should translate their philosophical investigations. They actually spend a time together in Vienna, Wittgenstein and ENSCOM, and so the relationship between her and Wittgenstein becomes very close. And finally, the last month, the last year, Wittgenstein is living at ENSCOM's house. And this goes until the January of 1951, when Wittgenstein was so ill that he had to move to his doctor's house. And in this January before, or around this move, he signed his will, which appointed then the three as heirs of his papers. This is how this piece, what I now present at the beginning of, should be rounded off. But as I said, I unfortunately couldn't manage it, and it would have been too long anyhow. So thank you very much for this moment.